canine detection collaborative, a detection dog training trio with Stacey Barnett.
Hi.
Robin Grubel.
Hey there.
And Crystal Wing.
What's up?
With humor and a big dose of theory, our trio talks practical training advice and features interviews with top trainers and scientists.
It's Canine Detection Collaborative!
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Canine Detection Collaborative. I'm Robin Grubel, and we're going to pick up on the interview that we were doing with Martha Hoffman. It's Crystal Wing and I interviewing her. And so I hope you enjoy part two of this wonderful interview.
One of my first gurus was Pat Cook. And I watched her for hours and hours. I took lessons from her. I eventually started helping her with training classes. Her main lesson was do not touch the chows.
And that's a very good lesson.
That's a good lesson, yeah.
Sorry, chow lovers. That's no hate there. It's just woof.
Yeah. So one day I asked her, I said, you have these superhuman reflexes. You are responding to the dog almost before it does the behavior, and you're doing the right thing. You know, how can it be that you're giving a treat before the dog sat or, you know, whatever? And I said, I don't have reflexes like that. It takes me like 3 seconds to see what the dog is doing. And she said, I don't have superhuman reflexes. She said, I know what the dog's going to do next. I respond to that. And that blew my mind because, like, I could learn to know what the dog was going to do next by its behavior. And I would feel kind of psychic if I knew that. And that was the answer. If you know what they're good, that is the only thing that evens out human and dog reflex differences. And for instance, Ivan Balabanov. You know, I used to think that he was a Malinois in human form. He was just as fast thinking and fast acting and clever and completely engaged with the dog. And that was also kind of a miracle to me. Wow, if I could get those reflexes to know what's happening in a fast-paced situation as opposed to AKC obedience, wow. Because protection bite sports happens fast.
Yeah, I feel very blessed to be as a decoy and a helper. I don't know if you know that that's something that I get to do. And to do that, you get to work with so many different, and my club has a lot of different dogs. I mean, we have Border Collie, Doberman, Beauceron, Malinois, Shepherd, you know, so I mean, I really get to work with a lot of different breeds. And I think that is also part of what builds that, wouldn't you say, is that you not only, it's not just the, I mean, you can specialize in one breed and be amazing at that, but if you really want to learn how to read the dog, to have a whole variety of dogs, how important would you say the variety and what you've done has helped you?
Oh, super important. The Rottweilers that were being bred back when I was in Schutzhund, they were very calm. They didn't see any reason to chase anybody. They saw reason to bite when they were approached beyond a certain distance, and they were dignified. And to get them to do the bark and hold was really difficult. And then people started breeding Rottweilers that were more prey oriented.
Yes.
And so all these different breeds were just very, very different, but there were not a lot of different breeds when I was training. So yeah. It's very cool that all of these different temperaments, because every temperament has its own instincts, and to do bite sports, they have to all be balanced and tweaked, and some of them coaxed up and some of them tamped. It's so complicated, even with a dog that has the perfect temperament for the sport.
Yes, so agree with that. Something else I wanted to point out, to become a better observer, one of the gifts that you have is being a photographer. And I have always, and I will continue to always thank Robin so much for giving me the experience to be a photographer out at her farm when all of the trainers came in, because I was able to be right there and hear all of the feedback and be able to photograph every single dog doing their thing. And the focus that that gives of really being zoomed in to see everything and then to go back and edit photos and look at every single one again. I just, even if you're not a good photographer, I feel like that is such a way to advance your skills. And when you said, you know, to go and watch and you're excited to have the 2 hours to watch, I'm the same way. I'm giddy about just getting to watch because that's where I feel like I'm learning the most. So do you want to speak a little bit about your photography and how you got into that and the importance that's been for you?
Well, it's the same as you, really, because, you know, especially with the Bali dogs or bite sports, things happen fast. At first, the dogs were all in my neighborhood, were all afraid of me. It was very hard to get a close-up photo. I was only using my iPhone. And then I borrowed my housemate's Nikon, and that improved things incredibly because he had a long lens. And then the dogs started to get used to me, and more people got dogs after COVID because the economy improved. So, but again, when I was clicking away, I'm just desperate to try and get the focus right, you know, and the settings right. But I did not see what I had until I got home and edited. And that's just fantastic. You know, I would be amazed, like, oh my gosh, look at these expressions.
And I think that about our training videos too. I really have to make sure that not only the photographs, I go back and I look and I look for details, but then in my training videos, I also try to have those same eyes and look for all my dog's body language there. And then my body language and the antecedent arrangements and what I was doing. Do you do a lot of recording of sessions and recording of the dogs that you're observing?
I'm doing more and more video. My camera has good video. I'm getting better at using it.
What are some of the things that you look for on your videos?
Oh, I want to see really clear behavior, and I want to see a good sequence. Like if it's a dog fight, you know, I want to see exactly what the expressions are. Taking stills from the video disappoints me because, of course, they're not the same quality. But I sort of try to have a balance. If something interactive is going on, I try to video it. If it's just one dog doing various things, you know, I snap individual. I'm getting better at the videoing. And I still don't know how to use all the functions on my fancy camera. but I didn't do pretty well at the basic stuff and exposures.
And you said that you're looking for a publisher, or you've already gone to the publisher about the videos that you're making with all of this, the views of the same behaviors.
Those are actually slideshows of individual shots.
Yeah. And have you found the publisher already?
Well, my dream is that Dogwise will think this is a fantastic advancement and brilliant idea, but I got involved with a lot of other things. I want to be able to present them with a really nicely edited video. I'm not the greatest editor yet, but I think if I show them some videos that are reasonable quality, that they'll get a ballpark picture.
Because I was wondering, like, if you have a Patreon or something like that, that, you know, for even more people to have access to what you're currently doing and have it on your platform even, is that something that would be a possibility?
Yeah, I have a Patreon account that I haven't done anything with yet. But yes,
I mean,
yes.
Yeah.
I get that.
And that would solve, that might be great. Yes.
Yeah, because I'm, take my money. Because I'm already seeing the benefits of, you know, like right now I'm going to the high schools and I'm doing body language and talking to them about being good observers. I'm talking to the future healthcare workers and our ESL students. And this is just so brilliant to be able to, even for kids and for, you know, people that aren't even in the dog world, of how amazing this could be and how it could reach way further than even all of us trainers.
Well, yes, my goal would be bite prevention as well as general dog knowledge for the more specialized trainers. But just to recognize from a distance don't go any closer. That could prevent a lot of bites.
Yes.
That one thing alone. The other thing is that a lot of my material is not suitable for Facebook, for social media, breeding. I've got, you know, I don't know, I must have 1,000 photographs of different breeding and aggression and mate guarding and all kinds of dog stuff that happens every day on the street. So I can't post any of that. But it's very interesting.
Something else you mentioned was about like a lifted paw and kind of what that meant in that context. And I think about how much I'm learning from my little search dog. His name is Radish. And I still am trying to understand the difference between her hunting crittering and hunting odor. And so the paw up critter, I can recognize that very easily because I see it in so many other dogs. But then there's the energy, the top line, you know, all of those things that there's slight differences. And so that's where I'm thinking, if there was a way after you have all of the people trained of watching and seeing all the images, that next step of with like pointy eared dogs, this is what I observe. And with some of the floppy eared dogs and some of the sight hounds, you know, if there's that next step, like that's my dream too, is to say, you know, these are the things we start to see within these breeds. Is that something that interests you or that you can kind of see next?
Well, sometimes the raised paw is a point, right?
Uh-huh.
When they're crittering. So I really don't see that much because I don't see these dogs hunting. They're pretty well, in my neighborhood, they're pretty well fed. Almost all of my photos of raised paw are either, you know, some kind of uncertainty. But that's interesting about the crittering.
We see that a lot in the detection dogs, that it's actually one of the common tells while they're working is that if they come into contact with something that resembles some sort of wildlife and not target odor, the foot comes up. And it's interesting that if looking at, and most of the stand and stares that I've seen people training as a trained final response that would normally look like a point, the dog has all 4 feet on the ground.
Ah.
And I've noticed that Radish does it every time that she comes across coyote poop, or, you know, other animal, you know, feces. Then that's when she really puts that foot up and she gets that really stiff posture.
It's fascinating. Yeah. So,
And then with Bali dogs, do you notice, are they, cause I'm not familiar. I mean, from what you've shared and things we've discussed, I know others aren't going to be that familiar probably. With the breeds, are they all very similar in breeds or are they pretty mixed?
In my neighborhood, most of them have Pomeranian or other foreign breeds mixed in. In the more remote villages, they look more pure, like the ancestral Bali heritage dog. But in any village, I'll see everything from pugs to pug mixes to dogs that look straight out of the Stone Age. So it's hard. It's actually kind of hard to find the real primeval looking dogs. But it's interesting to me. There are still so many of them left. They are genetically a dingo.
Ah, okay.
But they're nothing like a wild Australian dingo that's been feral for thousands and thousands of years. Hmm. They are domesticated, and they are domesticated to live in a culture where multiple families live in a walled compound, and they open the gates maybe in the morning to clean or go out or just leave the gates open all morning, and the dog sits by the gate where it wanders within 50 meters, and genetically, it doesn't want to wander. It has a very small territory that it defends by barking against strangers or other dogs sometimes. They're pretty good with other dogs, or snakes and giant lizards. So I believe that they've been culled for aggression to children, and that they have a really strong tendency to bark very threateningly or very fearfully, but they have a low tendency to bite. They do bite, but that's usually they bite tourists who think they're cute and mistake a wagging tail begging for food as please pet me. It's not please pet me, it's please share food with me. And they are shocked and horrified if someone strange touches them, and they might bite. But usually they have a huge range of warning signals, very carefully graduated, all kinds of growls and moans and all kinds of expressions and showing their teeth. Or it takes a lot to get them to bite. But touching them will do it if it's a stranger. My last project was with G. Khalsa. G has written a book called Cracking the Canine Code. So her book is about dog behavior. It's excellently written. And she asked me to use my Bali dog photos and a few photos of the interesting mixes of Bali dogs and others to illustrate the behavior book. So there's about 150 photos of mine in the book. And we had a lot of fun trying to choose a photo that illustrated each behavior that she talks about. And I'm just so happy with it. I'm happy with the clear writing and the way it goes in depth in a lot of behavior. And I'm just happy that the Bali dogs that are really unique and have incredibly clear social signals, very, very direct. They're just so transparent. And they were just the perfect thing to illustrate this book. And I love the Bali dogs, and I'm glad they're getting some recognition here.
Such important work you're doing. Thank you.
Yes. So that brings us, you had a post that you wrote on Facebook not too long ago about growling that seemed to get a lot of attention. And
I think too much.
Yeah, I think people underestimate the value and the information in a growl.
Okay, and here's what I thought was interesting. There were a lot of people like, you know, well, who is she even? And, you know, does she really even have any expertise? Because people don't really look to see who has done things, and they start to just make these statements. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys, you're, because they're like, she's probably never worked with an aggressive dog, or, you know. So there were a lot of comments that were made that I thought, yeah, you guys don't even really know who you're talking about. So would you want to share what the post was about and what your thoughts are?
Well, my thoughts are that there is a what I call a new wives' tale as opposed to an old wives' tale. And the new wives' tale is if you punish a dog for growling, it will go straight up the ladder of progressions to a bite, and it will no longer warn you. It will simply bite you. I don't happen to believe that, because I believe that if you stop a growl, you also stop the emotion that caused it. And of course, you do need to figure out why the dog is growling and solve that problem. So I know the growl is important, but my main point was people were saying the dogs have a voice. You have to let them have a voice. Well, the dog does have a voice, and it can say many things. If it doesn't want a person bothering it, touching it, handling it, approaching a bone, it has, I counted at least 15 non-aggressive, non-violent, tactful solutions that a dog has in its behavioral repertoire. Not all of them, but, you know, usually they have some. They could take the bone away to a hiding place. They could come up to you and frisk. If you're trying to cut their nails, they could playfully wrestle with you, and that distracts you from the attempt to cut their nails. If you're trying to pick a thorn out of their paw or something, some dogs will just very gently grasp your finger and pull it away from their paw, as if your finger was a burr. It's not a biting intention. Some dogs will submissively urinate, and then the person backs off. Some dogs will scream incredibly loudly if they're uncomfortable, and the person backs off. What else? Some dogs will try to distract you with various behaviors that are friendly. Some dogs will just go into a passive behavior, which is kind of sad, but that's in their temperament. So what I'm saying is they have a lot of different voices, and growling does not necessarily lead to biting, but I believe that backing away from growling encourages growling and encourages them to move up the ladder. And people disagree with me, but you still need to know what is causing the growling and solve that problem. It's just that people think that it's either growling or biting. Maybe I put that wrong. They don't realize that there are so many other ways that a dog can express discomfort that don't involve threatening behavior.
Yes. And what I'm hearing is almost all the examples you gave were all ways of distracting us from what was making them uncomfortable. And I think when I read a lot of the comments on just one of the threads, and a lot of what you just said, I think would clarify what the people were saying. So what I'm hearing is growling is one of the steps that's going toward biting in a lot of cases. Would you say that's kind of true?
It's kind of true. It can be a defensive sound, or it can be a threatening sound where the dog is going to advance towards you. The Bali dogs have a huge range of growls and moans and complaining noises as they race around me, trying to get out of my way or threaten me to get out of their lane. So people have made the point that there's a lot of sounds that dogs make, and some of them are not really growls, which is true.
Right.
But
also, how many people are really good observers? We kind of already talked about that. And so,
yeah.
And when they hear a vocalization, do they really know the difference in what the vocalization means? And when
right.
the dogs have other ways of distracting us, it would be beneficial if, we could help them communicate with those other ways. But by stopping some of the growling, we stop it first, like you said, figuring out why they're growling. So taking that piece, looking at what happened before the antecedent and figuring that out. But what I just heard that you said was the backing away is what's reinforcing the growling to make it happen more, which then could escalate to whatever the dog could do next. And I think that's the piece that I missed a little when I was reading it the first time.
Well, for maybe 20,000 years, people have been teaching dogs to bite people by threatening them in some way and then running away in terror when the dog reacts, even flicks an eye. And some protection training starts that way, usually with, personal protection trainers that want the dog to be defensive as opposed to a playful style of bite sport. But this has worked for thousands and thousands of years. You trigger the dog into growling or threatening with you, and then you run away.
Uh-huh.
Or you jerk your hand away. So if the dog wants to be left alone, that's incredibly reinforcing.
Right.
It's a time-proven technique. And even if you just walk away quietly, you've still reinforced it, in my belief. But lots of people don't agree with that. And, and the fact is, people have come up with a lot of really creative solutions to work on growling. And some of them are really effective. It's just the concept that dogs repress emotion, store it up, and release uncontrolled aggression at a future date that bothers me.
Yeah.
Because dogs generally are acting in the moment.
Right. And that's the thing I think that is missing in some of the context of the original post. I read it, but now hearing you say it, I'm understanding better. And I think the things I'm hearing is the figuring out why they growl, but then reacting to the growl instead of and reacting to any of these things instead of running away, of boring, being more neutral. Would you say that could be a better response? I use my own experience, right? That's kind of what we all do. So Yukon, when I give him a bath, he will say, "Hey," and he does like a low growl. And I will respond by saying, "Okay. Wait a second, and so I pause and then I'm like, "Okay, dude, are you going to be all right?" And I kind of talk to him again and then I can continue with what I'm doing. But just that pause, it's not retreating. It's just simply like, "Okay, I hear you." And then we can move forward. Would you say that that's, or is that kind of along the path of what you're saying?
Yes, they are so creative. And boy, they just have so many ways of telling us they don't want to be groomed or whatever, that don't involve a threat. So if they can learn that growling is not effective and that other behaviors work to make you stop, then they're going to use those other behaviors. They're not, it's not set in stone that they're going to use threatening or aggression or biting. They would prefer to avoid it, probably.
And I think that's where you got a little bit of grief in some of the comments about, okay, yeah, another person that says, do this, but they don't tell you how to do it. And I think some people assumed that it was going to be like a really severe punishment based is the comments that I was kind of gathering. And just from this little bit of discussion, it's more about reinforcing the things that are going to be more what you want. So if there's other situations where the dog can communicate with the gentle tug or, you know, the all the other ways you said, like I probably wouldn't reinforce the submissive peeing. I think some people got hung up on that. They're like, oh, great. I'm going to teach my dog to submissive pee. That's way better. I want pee on my couch. I'm like, oh my gosh, no, you're perseverating on the wrong thing here. But there are so many other ways that if we're good, keen observers, that we can reinforce that to build that as the communication tool. To be able to distract us, to be able to tell us that they don't like what we're doing. Is that kind of where you're going?
Yeah. And if we recognize those signals, we can sort of, you know, stop the behavior from escalating,
yes.
You know, and change the situation as soon as we can.
Yeah. So thank you for clarifying because, I needed that for me too, because I was trying to fill in the couple little pieces that I felt like I was missing. So thank you for that.
So I'm going to jump topics. And so one of the things that you said earlier kind of tickled my brain is one, that there were a lot of French bulldogs in Bali. And I believe you bred French bulldogs.
Wait, she said there's Pomeranians in Bali.
Oh, I thought it was French bulldogs.
Pugs.
Okay. Why pugs?
Because the Dutch invaders, colonists, whatever is the right term, had pugs and they brought them to Bali.
Oh.
And so they've just become an extremely popular pet probably over the last, I don't know, 50 years or so. And in 2005, I think, people started to be allowed to import other foreign breeds into Bali.
Okay.
And that created a storm of breeders breeding all different kinds of foreign breeds because people see them as a status symbol or they want a teeny tiny dog for a house dog. And Pomeranians are the most beloved of pets here.
Okay.
I'm curious too. You said we were chatting and you said something about the like the husky. Was that the breed that some people were saying was really popular? Or?
Yeah, it's a fad breed. And because a Bali heritage dog seems like they genetically do not want to leave their gate. They guard the gate by barking, and their territories are quite small. Some are 200 meters, some are less. They might roam outside if there's a female in heat or if they are a female in heat. But they want to stay home where the food is. They would like to guard their territory because that's where they're fed. They're not very aggressive with other dogs, but other dogs usually don't go into their compound, the other dog's compounds. So the first thing the husky does is to run away.
Which is a husky thing.
Yeah.
Because, just in general.
Because you forgot to attach the sled.
Right.
It's all your fault, Miss Pet Owner, because you forgot to attach the sled.
Yeah.
So people are absolutely aghast that they spend a lot of money on a husky puppy. And it has to be chained up because, or the gate closed because it will run. And if it runs, being a status pet, somebody might adopt slash steal it, and they never find it. Because the idea of training a dog to stay or come isn't very much of a concept. The dog comes because it loves its owners, and they're very bonded with their owners. They can be totally handled. It's just strangers that they don't like or trust, and they don't really want to leave their gate. And a dog that leaves its post is considered defective. Why would a dog leave? It's just a foreign concept to the person that's used to a Bali dog.
Huh.
And then, you know, here, that's foreign.
But what's going to happen is, like, a Pomeranian is a rather protective little tiny spitz, and they tend to have the same behavior.
Yeah.
They don't wander much, and they hang around the gate, and they bark at people. So the Balinese breeders and people have not yet heard of the concept of Pomskis, I don't think. But once they realize that they can have a miniature husky that's only as big as a Pomeranian, all hell's going to break loose.
It is. Oh, my.
Oh, because, I get
because,
that.
Because, you know, the combination of a tiny dog that looks like a husky is really going, people would just love that.
Oh, my
so
gosh.
That's my prediction.
What a confused little dog.
Yes. So, and you said that you had bred French bulldogs, right?
Yes.
Why?
I admit it.
and that probably sounded very accusatory, but
yeah,
it didn't,
there was some tone there. Right? Yeah,
it wasn't supposed to be that way, because, you know, I have my purpose for why I'm breeding labs and not a different breed. So, and everybody's got their thing, so it's fine.
Now you're backtracking. Good job. Okay, Martha.
Well, Kathy O'Brien is the most genius breeder ever. She has been breeding all of her life. Many, many breeds. She specialized in obedience training sighthounds and getting degrees on them. And so we started a project to breed Frenchies that could breathe, had open airways, were free whelpers, were athletic, but retained the original Frenchie temperament, which may have deteriorated these days. So we were successful in many ways. We were not able to breed free whelping dogs. We were able to breed dogs with longer muzzles that lived a long life, that had a perfect temperament. And the perfect temperament for a Frenchie is a lot of young couples buy a Frenchie to practice raising a child on. And, you know, they need to learn to communicate with each other about the child or dog's needs. And the thing about a really well-bred Frenchie that has a good temperament and will live more than a few years is that it's perfectly happy to be spoiled, and it won't develop terrible problems. There's not much aggression. There's not much fearfulness. It's just a happy dog that sees the world as a good place. And then often a really good Frenchie, when the real human baby comes along, it accepts it because it loves everybody. So in that sense, we were successful in breeding a healthier Frenchie that had the original temperament, that could breathe, and it had a more athletic structure, more rangy and fit. But what we could not achieve was everything. And looking back on it, I think we should have done what some of the pug breeders are doing. Pug X Whippet sounds ridiculous, but by the time there's 25% Whippet, it looks like a longer nose, more rangy pug.
Interesting.
And the people in Holland are breeding border mopsen. Mops means pug in Dutch. They are crossing border terriers with pugs.
Interesting.
And what do you think about
you get those? You get a happy little dog with maybe a little too much terrier instinct. But it's got a slightly longer snout, a little bit of a wire coat. It's very cute and happy. So all this reverse engineering of exaggerated breeds, I am 1,000% in favor of. And I realize now that even buying Frenchies from overseas in countries where they were not so exaggerated, we didn't get everything done, but I'm still happy that so many of our dogs had perfect temperaments and lived a life. Excellent. And did not need airway surgery. So the veterinarian that was the most experienced and popular with airway surgery for brachycephalic dogs, I asked him, how do you feel about doing these airway and nares opening surgeries? And he said, I feel so happy. When those dogs are getting enough of the oxygen, they get so much smarter and happier.
Good. Excellent.
You know, you might be happy to hear this, Martha. We have a Frenchie in our club, in our protection sport club, and Emily is doing a just genius job. I love, 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 love playing with her little Frenchie Arlo, and she shares videos all the time. And it's just, so I've fallen in love with her little Frenchie. So there's no judgment like there was from Robin. I'm kidding. I know there's no judgment. I'm being ornery.
Yeah. So,
I saw the progression now in mass production of Frenchies with no regard to temperament, and it's pretty sad. But the original Frenchie temperament is the most happy little clown in the world, and I felt having a Malinois and a Frenchie at the same time was like the perfect lifestyle.
Yeah, you're right. And he was very aggressive. She's really had to work a lot. Like, he wanted to kill everybody. And first time I went over and visited, you know, I was like squatting down on the little heat vent thing because it was really cold. And my friend Hack was there too. And she was like, okay, he would kill me if I did that. He came right up to me and he was a little clown, just like you said. I was booping his tail. Like, I can't tell which one's the front, you know, and we were having a great time. And they're like, wow, he's really come a long way. And he really has. She has done genius work with him. So I just love his little clown personality. You're right. I mean, of course you're right. You bred them. I mean,
yes, exactly.
So there's lots of different training thoughts and philosophies, and yours is motivation based. And, you know, you've covered that. And I'm curious, who do you follow? Like, what are your thoughts kind of on where you are now in your whole journey? Because you've had such a diverse, amazing career.
Well, the thing that fascinates me most, and I don't understand all of it yet, is Dr. Jack Panksepp. And his theory of emotional circuits fill in the holes that are in learning theory. For instance, the seeking circuit is what he calls any kind of prey behavior or searching for anything. And his idea is that the seeking circuit is instinctively self-rewarding, which explains why we go shopping and it's a fun experience, even if we don't find the item we wanted. And as far as evolution goes, an animal that gives up because it doesn't find prey is going to be less successful than an animal that has an internal drive to search for prey, whether it succeeds or not. So to me, that makes a lot of sense when you teach a dog to search for sounds or search for a person to alert to sounds, or like you guys do, alert to all different kinds of things, because that is self-reinforcing. There does not need to be a reward. It's great if there is, but I like the way that he separated it, the seeking circuit. It makes perfect sense to me.
How does that play with the emotional circuit? I'm missing that piece, I think. What is
he calls it one of the emotional circuits. I may be wrong in my understanding because I'm just starting to learn about this.
We're learning together.
But it all fits together. It all fits together very beautifully. And much as we all love learning theory, there are some parts of it that don't really work in real life. And this sort of is the missing link. Hmm. It's the emotional circuits and instincts combined with how dogs and animals and people learn.
Now I have a new thing to go out and read since the weather is brutally cold for the next week.
I'm almost positive that I've had his name before in my play notes. So now I have to go back and kind of see what it was that I have him. I've learned about that name before. So now I'm just fascinated to know where I came across it.
Interesting. Huh.
And I'm always curious about the emotional side, because that's the part that I feel like has made a tremendous difference between Radish, when I was very much about, here is my progression plans and I'm following this. And I had to really tap into, she's a very, she would probably make a great hearing dog. Like, from everything you've said, I was like, she checked all the boxes you were talking about. And so she's just very emotionally in tune to me. And so I really need to go that route. And so I'm very fascinated to learn more about his work and kind of see that connection. Because I think some of these dogs that are, you know, even our Malinois, like people think they're, you know, oh, they're just so tough and they're kind of disconnected. And oh my gosh, I think they're even more than we give them credit.
He has a 17-minute TEDx out there about the science of emotions.
Ah, okay.
And there's one that is labeled, what would art be without emotions? So that might be one of the things.
So it's my art, not my dog training. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm going to be checking out the TEDx from him this afternoon.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, right. I will too. I need to know more.
Okay. So Martha, we're quickly running out of time. And one of the things that we like to do is ask the people who've attended for a takeaway. And I will go first, since I'm typically the person that I'll let you guys think, since I kind of sprung this on you. I think my takeaway from this particular conversation is the benefit of looking at watching dogs, working on your observable behavior, or being able to understand and observe a dog's behavior. And for me, the little nugget of gold was when you were talking, one of the many, when you were talking about working with someone who said, I can deliver my reinforcement because I can anticipate, based on what the dog is doing, the behavior that they're next going to do, which is the behavior she wanted to reinforce. And which inspires me to think about that in a context of how fast can I reinforce my own dogs and be better with my observation skills.
So my takeaway when you said you clarified that the 5,000 eyes, our eyes, was not that you're an expert at that point, but that's just to begin, begin to start to understand. And that's my dream going forward, is to take the observations and then to be able to help articulate the things that I've learned to others since I've started to begin to understand with all of the photography and the viewing. And to try to find the other experts out there that can also articulate, now that we have this amazing vocabulary of images of what to look for, and that becomes more second nature, what next? So that's got my brain going quite a bit. And also the idea of the dog communicating with us by distracting us. I didn't really think about it that way before. And so that also tickled my brain. We were talking about the different ways that they can communicate when they're uncomfortable.
Martha, did you have any takeaways you'd like to share?
I would have to say that motivation is more important than training. Highly motivated but inaccurate dogs are better at alerting than highly trained but unmotivated dogs. So a lot of my courses involve getting the dog so highly motivated by using every life event the dog loves and associating it with the sounds, not just food and toys, but, you know, when, before you open the door to let it in the yard, beep the timer once. Before you let it out into the dog park, beep the timer. Everything, every good event should be associated with a sound. And that's one way you build high motivation. For instance, a dog that will wake itself from sleep voluntarily, then wake up a person who is resisting because they have a medication issue that makes them sleepy, or they're a deep sleeper. So they've got to be persistent and energetic getting that person to wake up. I believe that requires more motivation than any competitive sport. And hopefully, you know, when we do alerting training, we get both motivation and accuracy. And that applies to a lot of different facets of dogs.
I'm so thankful that you shared the motivation piece, because that's
agreed.
Yes, we're all about that here, and that's what the collaborative is all about. So that yes. You really summed that up beautifully.
Yes. Thank you, Martha, for spending this time with us. We greatly appreciate it, and I know that it's probably past your bedtime in Bali. So everybody who's listening to us on the podcast, know that everything we talked about, how you can find Martha, all of that's in the show notes. So please check those out and go train.
Canine Detection Collaborative. We appreciate the time you spend with us. If you liked this episode, not only should you follow us so you don't miss the next one, but please also rate and review us in your favorite podcast app. For info on collaborating with us, go to caninedetectioncollaborative.com. That's K9detectioncollaborative.com, where you can find our socials and pick up our latest monthly freebie. Join us again to talk training in the next episode.